Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411?
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. Dr. Anthony D'Agostino, psychiatrist, examines the trajectory of race relations during his lifetime in his recent book, Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism. He explores what it means to be a white American and the legacy of American racism. As a mental health professional, he looks through the lens of psychiatric perspective, offering understanding of the belief systems and motivations that perpetuate racial issues in America. Dr. Anthony D'Agostino, born and raised in Chicago into a Catholic Italian family. He fully acknowledges his place as a white American and the privilege he has enjoyed. He is board certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He shares 59 years of experience specializing in child and adolescent psychiatry. He discusses his book, Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism, A Primer for White People. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Joining me via the Zoom platform, I welcome Dr. Anthony D'Agostino from Chicago. Dr. Anthony, welcome to 411 Teen. So glad to have you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What inspired you as a psychiatrist to write a book on race relations and the legacy of America?
Well, you know, to tell you the honest truth, it was the election of Donald Trump in 2016. I thought that was kind of an interesting phenomenon. And I thought, well, you know, I think I need to better understand this. And so I thought a book about prejudice would be appropriate, since I think it was sort of a master. I still think he's kind of a master of, you know, manipulating prejudice. And so I thought, gee, I think I'll take a closer look at this and see what I can come up with.
Okay. Did you find that how has your background, I should say, growing up in Chicago, influenced your views on race and racism?
Well, you know, I suppose it has. I think wherever you grow up, in whatever environment, it's got to have some effect. I also, you know, been a psychiatrist for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that has certainly also influenced, because, you know, I think as a psychiatrist, you get to know an individual people, you know, fairly intimately in various ways. And so it's a little harder to be, it's harder to be a psychiatrist and have a lot of prejudices. I'm not saying we don't have them, because mm-hmm. we obviously do, but I think it's a little more difficult because you're forced to question, you know, some of your assumptions, especially as you get to know people better. You know, some of these assumptions seem silly, you know, mm-hmm. after a time. Mm-hmm. So I think it has influenced, you know, growing up in Chicago. Chicago is a place where, you know, I don't know how to put it, but there's probably every conceivable ethnic group. When I was growing up, you know, there was a different language. You know, every three or four blocks, you know, you'd run across a different language and different people. There was a lot of, you know, what I would call tribalism, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, people belong to their tribes and they, you know, sort of hung out with their tribe. I was raised initially in an all-Italian neighborhood. And I mean, there was nobody that I knew of in the neighborhood that wasn't Italian. You know, there were two languages spoken, you know, Italian and English. So you get a very sort of insular view of people in the world in that way. I mean, I It has its, you know, it has its charms, but it also has its liabilities. And so I in the book I talk a little bit about that, you know, what it was like in that area where I grew up. I later discovered that it was considered a high crime area in Chicago. I didn't realize that, you know, until I, because, you know, every it seemed like a great place to me. But just later on, when I went to college, I looked, I was reading a sociology book, and it said, well, in 1941, this was, you know, one of the higher crime areas in Chicago. And I mean, I was born there in 1941, and it seems so bad to me. So you get a different perspective. But you know, there was crime. There was, you know, crime was around. I mean, people there, you know, lock their doors. One of my relatives, one of my uncles went to prison, you know. I mean, he was a local drug dealer. But you know, it just didn't seem to mean anything to me. I mean, it was just, you know, it
Life.
was, well, this is life. This
Yeah,
is people. This is how it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't get all worked up about it. But it was kind of interesting. And one of my aunts married a fellow who ended up in the Federal Witness Protection Program. So you just look around and you say, well, you know, this is life and people, and you just have a different perspective on things. You don't expect things to always be just the way you would like them.
Right. Would you distinguish for the listening audience who have not read your book, prejudice, racism, and tribalism for them?
Well, you know, I felt the need to distinguish these different things. Now, you know, because and by the way, you know, I have a Facebook author page, and I get a lot of hate mail, actually, you know, on there for even bringing up the
I
subject.
wonder why.
So people, when they look at the title of my book, and also there's a podcast, by the way, of the same title. They look at it and they think they know what I'm thinking and what I'm saying. So I get people, you know, writing to me saying, you know, that I'm not a nice person and I'm bashing white people, and this is going to be, you know, you're going to criticize white folks. And I don't think I do. I
I
mean,
didn't see it that way. I'll be honest with you. I did read it.
yeah, I that was not my intention, but I do want to say things that I think need to be said, and so some people might take issue. But oddly enough, I think the 500 or so comments I've gotten, the negative comments I've gotten, have been mostly, I can't find a single person who read the book or listened to the podcast, but they sort of know what I'm thinking, they know what I'm saying, and they are attacking me for it.
That's why I ask you to distinguish, for the listening audience. So before they think they know it all, you can tell them exactly where you're coming from and what you mean.
Right. So, you know, I think prejudice I see as a human characteristic. We all live in worlds that give us a prejudicial view of life. And I use my own example in the book. I mean, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. I grew up, I went to Catholic schools my whole life, really. The only non-Catholic school I ever went to was a semester of kindergarten and medical school. I went to the University of Illinois. So other than that, I had only, you know, I went only to Catholic schools. So I got an insular view of life. I mean, I wasn't unhappy with it. I mean, I liked the people I met. I still like them. I still see them. And then I use my wife as an example. She's a Lutheran. And she went to all Lutheran school, you know, growing up. So, you know, went to Lutheran grade schools, Lutheran high schools. And what people forget, I think, is, you know, for example, in the school my wife was raised in, they spoke German in the grade school. You know, they spoke English, of course, but they, you know, they taught German. And between the First and Second World War, speaking German in America was considered subversive, and so they had to stop teaching German in the school because, you know, the Germans were bad people. So, you know, but you get that kind of person. You don't understand it. We've always had these feelings about one another. But, you know, since we had two wars against Germany, you have to stop teaching German in your school. But she could study German in high school, which was okay, but you couldn't teach German culture in children. And the same experience I point out in the book, the same experience with the Japanese, you know, who in Hawaii, you know, where they taught Japanese, they taught English, of course, and there were 157,000 Japanese people in Hawaii before the war, simply because they were plantation workers there, and they taught English, and but they also taught Japanese, and the teaching of Japanese became a subversive, you know, activity. So, you know, I try to point out, you know, there's nothing new happening in the world. Right. This has all happened before. We changed the labels, but the same things tend to keep happening. So what I say, prejudice, like, for example, even about Black people, I think if you raise in a white world, or if you raise in a Black world, you're going to get sort of prejudicial views about each other. I don't call that racism. I call that prejudicial views about one another.
I mean, so, everybody has prejudice. I mean, would you agree? I mean, it's not innate. It's not innate. I mean, you aren't born with it. But it is somewhat dictated by your milieu, your environment.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Okay. But I think it's innate in the sense that we all just, I mean, if you're 3 years old and you're growing up in a certain area and you've lived there for 12, 15, 20 years, you're going to have the cultural prejudices of that area.
Yeah.
You simply are. You're not going to. And I use, if you read the book, then you read, I gave the example of the.
This is one of those times. I hate to interrupt you. This is one of those times. We need to take a quick break, and I'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and we are honored to have Dr. Anthony D. Agostino, and he is talking about his recent book, Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism. Dr. D. Agostino, I had to interrupt you. Would you like, I'm so sorry, to continue your thoughts?
Well, I was just pointing out that, you know, I use the example of the Black woman who later became a psychologist, that she was raised in an all-Black area, and then she moved to an area that was, you know, probably mostly white. And she talks about, you know, trying to get adjusted, and she says that, well, the people, when she was 12 years old when she moved into this neighborhood and went to this school, and actually people were pretty nice to her. She didn't know what to expect, but then folks were, you know, pretty nice, and but she had trouble remembering their names because all white people looked alike to her. so it was one of these things where, you know, and she was embarrassed about it, and she knew that, you know, that it was her problem, but, you know, it took her a while to really get over that. Then she goes on to Harvard College, and she gets a PhD there as well. And and she gets a PhD, and she learns that, well, there is such a thing as the other race effect. And everybody goes through that.
Exactly.
And then she goes to the example of the Japanese women, you know, who, you know, when some Black kid would snatch their purse or whatever, they had, because they all the Black kids looked
all
alike.
Look alike. Right.
So you have to understand that there are some innate prejudices here that that is kind of innate.
Kind of, yeah.
You come by it.
Eugenics there. We'll put it in there. Okay.
I talk a little bit, you know, about what is racism. And again, I realize everybody can have their own definition. I'm not telling you what you think. I'm only saying that I think that if prejudice is a synonym of racism, that's not a really good way to go. I use some examples, but then I use the example of the NFL. When I'm watching the NFL football games, I see "End Racism" on the back of some of the helmets. I sort of ask, well, what does that mean? And again, I do talk about racism, and I use the definition of racism as it's not an individual thing, but an institutional thing.
Okay.
When you see "End Racism" on the back of a football helmet and they're playing the game in Texas, what does that mean? Why does Texas allow that? And my conclusion is they know it's nonsense because they use the definition of racism as an individual matter. And so they're okay with it because what it means is we should all be nice to one another, which is, you know, great. Great. It's just that the Texas legislature is not going to pass any laws that make it any easier for, you know, non-white people to vote or to do all kinds of things. But, you know, they can tolerate the thing on the back of the helmet, which is defined as everybody should be nice to one another. Oh, yeah, we're all for that, aren't we? Yeah, it'll never happen, but, you know, we're not going to pass any laws to make life any easier for anybody. But so the racism part is what the legislature does, is what I'm saying. So that's why I think we have a separate definition of it. Okay. And the same way with tribalism. I think tribalism is also kind of a natural thing in the sense, and I think it's kind of hardwired in human beings, because I think from an evolutionary point of view, it's a way of staying alive.
Mm-hmm.
So you hang with your tribe. Your tribe takes care of your needs, but your tribe doesn't care about the other tribe. They care about your tribe. And so you devote all of your, you know, your energies and your allegiances to your tribe, because in some ways we're sort of inherently that way. We got that way through, you know, millions of years of evolution. And it's hard to get out, but there are plenty of as a doctor, I understand that there are plenty of inborn things that we have. For example, the allergic response is the antibody. These are all normal things that protect the body, but on occasion they become the things that kill us. an allergic that can kill you. So these things, even though they're natural, we have to somehow find ways to deal with these things, because even though it's a natural response, if you live in a multicultural society, you have the choice of either killing each other or finding a way to live with one another. You've got those two choices, basically, is what it comes down to. So that's why I make these definitions different, you know, and I try to point some of those out.
Yeah, I appreciate that, because to me, the differences are important. And you know, even though the definitions, how can I say, they might be similar, like you said, but they're not synonyms, okay? Racism is objective. And it's tangible too,
right? And if you define it as institutional, then you know what you want to fix,
right?
But if you're walking around saying, "Oh, we all got to love one another," and you know, when we do, we'll all be happy. Well, that'll never happen. It's never gonna happen. Forget it.
Right. And then bigotry. I mean, prejudice and bigotry are really, we're talking about feelings.
Right.
You know, whereas racism is a, I think you pointed this out, is a doctrine are a policy.
Right.
So those are real clear to me differences.
Right. You know what you want to fix.
Right.
So you know, you say, well, do you have to love one another? Well, it's nice. Yeah, I mean, but we all want that. Yeah, it's a good thing. But let's, if we have to, if you can fix something by passing a law. And so the legislatures of the country, they have a lot of power to make things different. You know, like, for example, in Alabama, you know, or many states where you gerrymander, so you can neuter, you know, the power of other people through the way you draw the map. So, and that's racism.
Mm-hmm.
And, just not liking one another, that's prejudice.
Yes. Yeah. We were talking about language also, because we were talking about the German. What role, from your perspective, does language play in cultural prejudice?
Well, I mean, it plays, you know, very important roles.
Okay.
In fact, I think that's, you know, part of the power, you know, why I was so fascinated by, you know, the presidential win of Donald Trump, both in 2016 and in 2024, because it's, I think it's sort of like a tutorial in tribal prejudice.
Uh-huh.
And understand tribal prejudice, you understand what's going on. So the other aspect of the book that I, you know, the other point of reading the book is my argument that prejudice is profitable.
Uh-huh.
It is a profitable undertaking. And I use one of the examples I use is the Fox News judgment. There was a judgment against Fox News, as you know, for $787 billion.
Yes.
For what? For, you know, lying to your the people that you broadcast it. But to some extent, you have to understand that the people want to be lied to. So it's worth it. So they have not only Dominion voting systems to give money to, but they have another voting systems company that they'll probably be paying out just as much, but you won't hear about it because they got beat up, you know, with this.
Right.
So they're going to quietly pay something like that to this other company. But basically, it's a news agency that says there's money in prejudice. There's big money in this. There's lots of money. So we have to be, you know, we want to make money. So what we do is we tell the people what they want to hear. So the news is supposed to be something you report to people. You tell people what happened. But you know, many news outlets, their function is not to inform, but to make money. And you do it by, you know, by telling people what they want to hear. And there's a lot of money in this. And also, you know, as a physician, you know, who's practiced in hospital environments all of his life, we look at, you know, I always was puzzled why everybody hated Obamacare. You know, maybe it was because of Obama, they hated him, but I don't think so, because even before Obama attempted to develop a national health system, you know, Hillary Clinton tried it, you know, 20 years in the 90s, they got, you know, beaten up. You know, she tried to set up some kind of national health system. And why do poor working class, well, not poor, but let's say working class white people, why do they not want health insurance? It's puzzling to me. It's always puzzling to me. You know, I'm not a young man. And so I ended up in the hospital in April, and I was there for 5 days. It came out with a bill for $99,000.
Oh my God.
You say at $20,000 a day, and I've got, I've got good health insurance, so I had to cough up some money, but not that much. And so why do people object to having health insurance? It's always puzzled me, greatly. So Obama finally gets, health insurance passed, some kind of health insurance for people who are, and I mean, it's Obamacare is not public aid because we already have that. Obamacare is for people who are working and who, don't have a lot of money, but they're working and they're supporting themselves and their family, and they work in jobs that don't have health insurance. So, this is an opportunity. But people hated it. They hated it. And you wonder why they, I can't figure out why they hated it. And I think the reason they hated it was twofold. One is that, I think the Democrats, snuck it up on the Republican. The function of Republicans, apparently, is to make sure that very wealthy people don't pay high taxes. I think that's the function. And it sounds cynical, but I get the feeling that that's a big important thing. So if you have like billionaires, you want to give them low taxes so they can give you money and support your campaigns. You want to take tax money away from them so they can't, support your campaign. So that's always puzzled me, why that is the case. And even in when Trump was, during his first term, I mean, his big thing was, I'm going to destroy, I'm going to throw out Obamacare. And I could never figure that out. Like, why do you not want health insurance, folks? Do you want to stay in debt? I mean, the biggest cause in the United States for bankruptcy in most of the people of the United States
There's
is
medical
medical
bill.
debt. Medical debt. So why don't you want to not have that? I can't understand it. Well, because the guys that are going to give you that, the guys that are going to give you $35 a month insulin, the guys are going to get, these are Democrats, and you hate these people
That's right.
because, they do really bad things like take away your guns. They want to take away your AR-15s. They want to tell you that, there was slavery in this country. They want to tell you all the things you don't want to hear. So what we do is we say, this is an outrage. We don't want. And then when John McCain, when they were visiting, when the Senate was voting on whether to eliminate Obamacare or not, it was very, very close. And John McCain had the last vote, and he voted to keep it. And Trump
That,
hated him
yeah, even
ever
more.
since. It's
Ever
sort of
so.
like, but he, and he kept saying, "Oh, I've got this wonderful health care. You're all going to love it." There was no plan. There was no health care. I mean, it was nothing. And so it puzzled me. The power of prejudice is so strong that a white working class person will vote against $35 insulin, instead pay $700 or $800 a month for insulin because he doesn't like,
He folks
because they're going to take away his
yeah
AR-15.
yeah
Or in this last election, I think it was brilliant because all you heard about was
Trans,
transgenders,
yeah, oh
people,
God, yes,
like, Kamala wants to cut off your genitals, and of your
oh
children.
God, yeah.
But it's so laughable, it's
It is,
tragic.
it is. Well, how would explain briefly what white supremacy is and how it has been carefully nurtured to preserve the current power structures, in your view? And because all this kind of runs together. At least from where I sit, it all runs together.
As I say to the people who send me hate mail, I'm a white person. I like white people. All my best friends are white people, so I'm not against us. But here's what I think is there's something called white privilege. Now,
Yes.
my definition of white privilege is, the way I describe it in the book is I kind of, I mean, I like it. I mean,
Yeah.
I'm not gonna run away from it. In other words, white,
It's
white
just the
calls
advantages of
good.
being white.
Yeah, there are advantages, and I'm not
Right.
gonna run away from those advantages. However, what I say is that if you think that somehow you deserve more because you're white, so the way I explain it is, that many of our European ancestors, they were, heavily into science. They, especially in the 17th century, the 18th century, they developed all kinds of, they developed ships that could travel the oceans. They were technologically more advanced. For example, when the North Africans invaded Spain and took over Spain for 700 years, they were more advanced. They were technologically, they were scientifically more advanced. If you wanted a science education in 750 AD, you went to North Africa. You went to the Islamic countries because they were more advanced. So the European countries became more advanced. So because,
Hold your
they're,
thoughts here, and
yeah.
because we're going to take a brief break, and I'll get right back to you. And you can finish your thoughts. You're tuned into 411 Teen, and I am talking with Dr. Anthony D'Eschino.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Just tuning in. The program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I am talking with Dr. Anthony D'Eschino. He is the author of Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism. And Dr. Anthony, I had to interrupt you, and you're
No
back in the
problem.
seat.
No
Okay.
problem.
Okay. If you wanted to continue, I think we were talking about, white supremacy and and privilege and
Privilege. Well, I was trying to describe privilege. Now, the privilege that, most white people have experienced in the last 500 years has been based on the fact that, all cultures are in competition with one another,
Of course.
always. And, it seems like Europeans got ahead of most of the other cultures in the world, and they exploited that. Now, I'm not going to apologize for that because that was like, Genghis Khan conquered all of Asia, and I'm sorry, but he did, and he got, Mongol privilege during that period. Well, white people developed technologically. They had, they developed, education. They started universities. They studied science and, got ahead of most other cultures. However, and as a result, as a white person, some of that floats down to me, and I'm not going to run away from it, tell you the truth. On the other hand, when somebody, like if my son is born into the world and somebody else's, your son is born into the world at that moment in time, we as white people, we inherit white culture, and white culture is technologically, has in the past been technologically more advanced. So I'm not going to apologize for that. However, when somebody is born today in the United States of America, and one family has, makes $500,000 a year, and the other family makes $50,000 a year, there's going to be more privilege in the kid whose family makes 500,000. Now, even if that's a black family makes 500,000, that kid's going to have more privilege, at least of certain kinds, than somebody who's born into a family that makes $50,000 a year. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. But that you know, when that those two people are born on the same day in the same area, there's no inherent, there's nothing inherent in the fact that your family makes more money that makes you more worthy than the person born in the family that makes less money. Is you are more advantaged, and if you want to use the word privilege, that's mm-hmm. fine with me, but there's nothing inherent, there's no
exactly
there's
right.
under God, or there's nothing in the Constitution that makes this mm-hmm. person more worthy than this other person. And but some people feel, well, you know, I'm a white person and I should have.
Right.
No, there's no reason why you should. You were maybe lucky enough to be born into a family that, you know, made a lot of money, and therefore you can get more education. But
or just lucky enough to be born white.
It's right. It's
okay.
Just,
yeah.
And if you're lucky enough, great. I mean,
yeah.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Well, you know. I'm moving on because time is flying, and a couple of things I want to get you to address. You mentioned the attempts to sanitize American history that served to maintain white supremacy. How do you see this playing out in our current political and educational context?
Well, unfortunately, I see it getting worse.
Okay.
Now, you know, here's my reasoning. You know, like, why, if I'm a white person, do I care?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I care because I think the whole thing is going to blow up at some point, and I think that my descendants, my children, my grandchildren, I don't want them to live in a world where everybody's, you know, shooting at one another and lying. I want them to get, if they go to school, I want them to know what truly happened. And I, you know, want them to understand that you don't want to be complicit in maintaining something that's a fraud. So you have to deal with the realities of life. Now, you know, to surround yourself with fictional narratives is, to me, you know, maybe there's a short-term advantage. I think it's long-term, it's going to be a disaster for the country. And I think, unfortunately, I think the country is moving toward let's just sanitize everything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I've been alive for over 80 years. I have never, ever, I've never had a controversy where librarians were at the center of the country. I've never heard of that in my life ever. As a white person, I have to say, well, let's at least be realistic, let's at least be honest, and let's compete in the world, and if we're better, it'll show, and if we're not, but to prop up some kind of crazy narrative just because somebody's mm-hmm. feelings might get hurt is silly. It's silly. It's demeaning, actually.
Yeah.
At least from my point of view. So that's how I see
okay.
it.
Okay. How about the legacy? I want to talk about the legacy. How does the legacy of racism affect Black Americans on a psychological or emotional level, especially when we start looking at intergenerational trauma?
Well, you know, what I try to point out in the book is that I'm not a Black person, so I can't speak for the Black
mm-hmm.
experience. However, I there's one point in the book where I point out that there are a lot of murders in Chicago, and 80% of the murders are Black-on-Black murders. So that is the legacy of racism, as far as I can see. And this is what happens when you don't solve problems when you can solve them.
Mm-hmm.
When you choose to walk away, they get worse. And so, you know, I don't want to live in a world like that. So, but I see the crime statistics as a manifestation of, mm-hmm. of racism over the years, and that's going to be difficult to dig out of. But I don't think you dig out of it by denying that it exists.
Denial.
That's, you don't solve a problem by saying that. You have to admire Donald Trump, though. He solves problems like nobody else. For example, when we had the pandemic, he said, let's see, and people were dying by the thousands, and every day the number of cases was multiplying. What kind of a solution do you have? Okay, brilliant solution. Let's not do any more testing from now on, and then we won't look, and the cases won't go up anymore.
Right. Or we won't talk about it. You know, or that's another way. You just don't talk about it.
So the reason we have COVID and all these cases is because we're counting them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is Donald Trump reasoning. It is psychotic reasoning, but it somehow seems to work. Now, the other issue is we've got this global warming problem, and, you know, Florida now has a hurricane about every 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And in Chicago, in the area in Illinois, we have 10 tornadoes. You know, we have 15
true.
Tornadoes.
What
last
is
night.
Going
we
on?
We have one tornado. Yeah. Right. So, you know, so he can say, well, we've got this problem, but we solve the problem by saying there is no problem. Internal reaction.
Right.
So if this is how you solve your problems, I can only foresee bad things happening.
Well, as we look at racism, how does it, and it does, it affects white Americans differently. Talk about, just briefly, how racism impacts white Americans differently, and maybe the mental and emotional barriers that exist in just even, what I want to say, in confronting this reality. Because it does affect them differently, and there are some barriers, emotional barriers and mental barriers, that exist when you confront this reality.
Right. I mean, I you never solve the problem ever by saying that you didn't have the problem.
Right.
So you don't ever solve any problem in science, in medicine, in any discipline by saying the problem doesn't exist. And I mean, interestingly enough, Donald Trump just won two presidencies in part saying that all the problems you have don't exist, and just follow me and I'll fix everything by saying it doesn't exist. So I think the issue has been an insidious effect over many, many centuries. There's no question about it. At what point do we say we want to do something about that? Now, I think, you know, many conservatives are very critical. They'll say, well, back in the 60s, we did this, we did this, we did that, and it didn't solve the problems. Well, I don't think that's totally true. I think it did solve some of the problems. It didn't solve all of the problems. And maybe some of them are unsolvable. But certainly some of them are solvable. And to ignore the obvious is just, you know.
But you got to want to solve them, for real. I mean, genuinely. You got to want to solve them.
What shall we do about this? Well, we deal with this by A, define it, and B, suggest solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you know, there's going to be a lot of controversy about, you know, what's a solution. But I think even if you do nothing else, if you simply do things like allow people to vote, allow people to be represented, allow people to do the jobs they can do, that's not going to solve all problems, but it's going to help.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set up barriers to these kinds of things, you put the problem off until another day. You know, I didn't write this in the book, but I sort of in the podcast, you know, I'll speculate. What would happen if at the end of the Civil War, we gave every black family 20 acres and a mule, which was the proposal. And you had all this land because you had all these people who had just rebelled against the United States, and it's perfectly legitimate to take their land away because they were in rebellion. They were making war against you. Therefore, 20 acres, and I mean, the whole history of racism in the United States would be different because there would be, you know, more, you know, more people would be elevated to the middle class through their own work, through their own efforts. Some will fail, but many will succeed. And I think the economic situation, you know, between blacks and whites in the country would be much different if that had happened. But it didn't happen. You know, they shot Abe Lincoln. He was the only person who could have really pulled this off because he had moral authority. People had respect for him. I mean, they used to refer to him as the gorilla, by the way. You understand? Uh-huh. That was the way his cabinet referred to him in the beginning, as the gorilla, because they felt he was stupid. And I mean, he never went to a university, but he was obviously pretty bright. And so if those things had been addressed at that time, they weren't.
Yeah. We have 3 minutes remaining, and I have a couple questions I want to get to you, so if you don't mind. First of all, I think tell us where we can purchase your book, Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism, if you have a website or any way that individuals keep in contact with you. So will you share that now?
It's of course at Amazon.com, of course, uh-huh. My name, at BarnesandNoble.com, you know, you can get the book there. I do have a website, Anthony D'Agostino, no apostrophe, uh-huh. Anthony D'Agostino MD.com. But that'll certainly bring you to the Amazon site. So okay. Amazon or Barnes & Noble sites is probably the best place. There are a few other places, but I can't remember. I don't remember what they are. Sorry.
That's all right.
And my podcast, by the way, is on Spotify. It's on Spotify for podcasters. It's on iHeartRadio, Radio Public, Acast, and Good Pods. So it's there if you don't like reading the book and you just get a little. The podcast is a very, very abbreviated version of the book.
Okay.
Very abbreviated.
For listeners who may be uncomfortable confronting issues of racial prejudice or white supremacy, what advice would you give them? Brief advice, 1 minute.
That's really a tough one. I would say, you know, try. I mean, I write the way I write my book. I write it as if I'm talking to a white person.
Uh-huh.
I don't try to speak for black people in my book. I only speak for me and white people that I know. So I think, you know, give it a try or listen to the podcast. I'm not going to bully people. I'm not, you know, calling them sinners. I don't do any of that.
No.
I just try to, you know, take an honest look and look at real history you know, come to your own conclusion. It seems like the flow of history is not going in that direction, but, you know, I'll suggest it. So.
Okay. Well, I just want to extend to you a real sincere appreciation for your time and invite you to come back, because there are so many things we didn't have the opportunity to discuss or explore. But I want to say thank you. I appreciate you sharing your time and your insight with 411 Teen. I've been talking with Dr. Anthony D'Agostino, author, of Prejudice, Racism, and Tribalism, Exploring the Legacy of American Racism. Dr. Anthony asserts the problem with America is not that there are too many white people. The problem is that white people are afraid of change and have given up on democracy. It's time out for this edition of 411 Teen. Again, I have been talking with Dr. Anthony D'Esquino, author, psychiatrist. Again, thank you so much to my listening audience. Much appreciation for your time and ear. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Teen at wfsu.org.